Hey there. You know, if you're a frequent listener to our show, you already know that our show is brought to you by our friends over at Artillery Sports. But what you may not know is that Artillery Sports helps athletes of all types win on and off the course and court. They do this by selling quality, durable, and precision manufactured sports equipment that keeps you in the game, while also using a portion of the profits to provide the funding needed to care for our nation's veterans. With Artillery Sports, it's more than just a game. So head over to artillerysports.com today to buy the quality equipment you need to keep you in the game and to help our nation's veterans at the same time. That's artillerysports.com. Make sure you head on over there today. Oh, and use the code DOCFIRST to get 10% off your first order. Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host and a documentary filmmaker myself, Christian Taylor. Welcome to part two of Movie Rob Minute number 131. Now, if you are just joining us and haven't listened to last week's episode, stop. Go no further. Go back and listen to that episode and then come back and pick up here. You see, we're taking a bit of a break from our regularly scheduled program to share with you a great podcast called Movie Rob Minute. In part one, we ended with a question from me to Corey. What was it like on your first day of shooting? Tell me everything. How did it go start to finish? What was it like? What did you have to do? And in this episode, we continue the conversation, diving deeper into Corey's experiences with plenty of side stories along the way. We eventually break down this minute of Saving Private Ryan like we were supposed to do. I share my own perspective, drawing parallels from the journeys of veterans that I've met and my sons who are currently serving in the military. And you'll hear how we came up with the episode title, A Fawn of Crap, as well. And in the final 20 minutes, we'll shift gears to talk about the legendary John Williams in a segment we called Maestro Mondays. We'll share our top five movie score themes as well and discuss the reasons behind our picks. Enjoy, everybody. I just want you to answer the question really simply, and then we need to move on to the next minute.
Right.
So when you had your time, your moment in the sun, you basically were just sitting on a beach. They put you on a beach. Tell me exactly what you had to do when it was your time to shoot. Okay. I want to know, from the beginning to the end, what was your day of shooting like? Did it take one day, 2 days? Like, give me what you had to do, please.
Half a day.
Okay.
Half a day.
Half a day. What'd you have to do?
We got to my bit because he would shoot it incrementally. He'd shoot the bit up to where Tom Hanks gets blown, his eardrum blown out or something, and he can't hear, and his hand is shaking, and he's looking around, and he sees a guy walking with his arm going, oh, there it is, picks up an arm and goes off, like he's got only one arm now, but he picks up his arm and goes off. Other guys just screaming, you know, this, that, and the other. And he finally gets his shit together and puts his helmet on. And so they shoot that sequence, and then they shoot the next sequence where he runs to the foxhole and he buries himself in the foxhole and he finds his guys. And that's when Sizemore rolls over and says something to him. And then he leans across and grabs me because he's getting the information. Where are we? We're supposed to be here, but we're not here. How do you know we're not here? Because these guys are supposed to have come in and done that, but they haven't. So that's why he's saying, you know, cat F, dog one is not open. It's not That's open, right. Meaning they're going to bring these ships in and they're going to back up on the shoreline where they're going to be sitting ducks for these things. They're saying, hold them off. We haven't blown things, you know, up yet. So that's where I come in. I'm the one who's going, now we've got these guys come in and these guys are here and everything's moving through. So keep them coming. I'm the contact with the shore. I'm the shore party, you know, sure. And they're all, you know, so he's calling me shore party, grabs me, pulls me over. He says, say again, dog one is not open. I repeat, dog one is not open. Throws me back. They find it's a shore party, grabs me again, says another line. Now, the whole time I'm sitting there, and all I've got to do is literally, I'll show it to you.
Roll over.
I'm just rolling like this with a thing in my head going, and rolling out. And the second time I did it, I had two absolutely enormous guys. I would roll out and reach my hands out. They would grab me, pull me out. Right next to me was the dummy with blood bags just right in the face. And they'd roll it in. Tom Hanks would grab, shore party. My face is blown open. Blood's coming out of it. He just goes, I mean, that was like something out of a Hammer horror film.
That's right, because the face just caved in. I actually always thought that was CGI. I didn't realize it was a dummy.
No, no.
Well, so wait a second. How? Wait. You're going too fast. Okay,
that's
wait.
Me. I talk
someone
fast.
Who knows the movie?
It's never boring with me.
So okay, so you're acting, and so the two guys that pulled you out, they pulled you out, stuck a dummy in, and then
there was
dummy
a dummy
stays-
next to me. It was a dummy next to me in the foxhole, ready to go, just out of frame. I would roll in, lean in. I did it again, rolled in, lean in. The third time I was supposed to do it, before the third time, they reach in because Tom Hanks is talking to Tom Sizemore. So the camera goes from here to here, from here to here. And then they pull me out, replace me with the dummy. It comes back to here. Tom Hanks is here. The dummy's here, gushing blood. Tom Hanks grabs the thing. The dummy slides down. He slid down and slid away. They just pulled him by the legs and pulled him out.
I see.
Right. And then Tom Hanks picks up the radio and realizes.
So Kedav, short party. The radio's dead. Yeah. So they're screwed.
And that's what they did. I mean, I realized, like, I could never watch Saving Private Ryan. And I had a friend that was a director, and he's like, "You were going to watch this." And I was like, "I can't. It's just, this is when I was doing directing." And he's like, "You cannot do this film unless you watch Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers. So you're going to watch this, and we're going to watch it at slow speed. And you're going to realize that this is movie magic." And so he did. He slowed everything down for me. And I realized, oh my gosh, those are dummies. And so I learned that every single one of those things that exploded, like lost their legs or whatever, were dummies.
Well, some of them.
Some
of them were amputees. Some of them had lost an arm previously, and they just were hired to look around. They had a shredded kind of sleeve that was bloody, and they'd find a piece of arm, and they'd go, "Yeah, this'll do," and walk away, you know?
Wow.
Because that's what happened.
Yeah.
You know? That's what I'm saying. Some of these guys were like, you know, what's his name? Upham, where they were just so terrified and screaming, and some of them just had no awareness of the significance of the fact that their arm was no longer attached to their bodies.
Yeah. It's kind of like shock.
Oh, complete shock. Yeah.
So how many takes?
Oh, I don't remember doing more than a handful. This is the other thing I was going to say. 20, 30 takes. That ain't him. 2, 3, 4. That's him.
Hmm.
That's him. That's what he does.
So then you were done.
I'm not going to waste. No. Then we had another thing where he wanted a bunch of actors to say, I can't remember the line. He wanted us to say a line, a sequence of lines, like, I can't remember. I'll just make some. I mean, it could be like Tom Hanks line. Shore party. Cat F, dog one is not open. Repeat, dog one is not open. Okay, say that like you're freaking. Cat F, dog one is not open. You know, we're all saying this. Then. And some of the guys, God love them, some of the guys can't do it. They can't say it. They're either Irish Army guys or they're you know, just really actors who are used to playing nice people, and they don't get what this situation is. And so I popped off and I said my line. He says, "Do it once more." And I said it again. And he goes, and I'm literally, I was having pictures taken with my dummy. I've got a picture somewhere of me and my dummy with the face blown off.
Okay,
and so
I'm hugging that.
I'm hugging. I don't know where it is. Katrina took so much of my memorabilia. It's scary. I'm hugging my dummy and they're taking pictures. And he says, "Can you say that line?" And I put the dummy down and I said, "Dah, dah, dah, dah." And he said, "Say it another time. Say it like this." And he says, "Okay, give me one where you're doing this and let it come." And he looked at the AD and he said, "This guy's a good actor. Can we get him in something else?" And I picked up the dummy and I went like this. I just looked at the dummy and I went, "You got to ask this guy because I don't think I'm going to be in the rest of the movie." You know,
that's awesome.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, that's the stuff you remember. Stuff you remember, though.
Is that why you got in Band of Brothers?
No, I got in Band of Brothers. Same thing. I auditioned for another role and didn't get it because, you know, they were casting who they cast. And it was beautifully cast, Band of Brothers. And, you know, I was just
frustrating that, like, he can say that. So Steven Spielberg said that to you.
Yeah, but I'm sure he said, look, there was an armorer on the set. It was on Band of Brothers as well. And I worked with him on something else as well as Private Ryan. And he would, you know, say, you know, okay, you've got a sidearm. Here it is. It's no bullets. See, the chamber's empty. Click and that and that. And he showed me, now, when you hold it, because they used to just, they wouldn't train you. Private Ryan, they were the first movies where you'd really did this training. The '90s was where, you know, they really
Dale Dye.
Exactly. So they would show us how to do. And Simon Atherton, I know it was a stock line. He'd come up and he'd say, you know, he'd see me one morning and say, "Hello, Corey." And I'd say, "Hi, Simon. How are you?" He said, "Very good, very good." And I said, "How's everything going?" It's a chat about this. Here's your gun. It's this. You could click it like that. And I'd say, "So it's all ready to go." I'd say, "Simon, thank you so much." And he goes, "It's all right. Can't do enough for a good actor." And I know he said that to everybody. You know, it was just his stock line, like saying, "Top of the morning to you. Can't do enough for a good actor." And that's what he would say. It made you feel great. You know, but that's why they're good at what they do, because they make you feel like you're talented.
You are talented, and Steven Spielberg was right, and you should have been given more roles.
Well, no, you know, I mean, I did what I did. I loved doing what I did. I thought it was great what I did. And, you know, that was me done. And I went home like the next day, which was great. I was a week in Ireland, you know, and I was in Private Ryan.
And you got to have all that meat.
And I got to eat the beef, all that beef. I had my beefing. I haven't had a similar beefing in my life. I haven't ever had that much beef in 1 week in my life.
All right.
I'm telling you, I think I bought a heart attack. I'm not sure.
Well, you're still here. So that's already
I am still here. Yeah, yeah. So it's good.
And we are talking 27 years. So I don't think if God forbid you get a heart attack, it's not going to be from that.
And congratulations for answering the questions directly. I'm very thankful.
You're so lucky.
All right. So because we've talked about so many other fascinating things, we're just going to quickly go through this minute, you know, just of everything that's going on. If there's anything you guys want to point out as we go through it, feel free. So the scene changes, and then we have Henderson and Mellish getting their gun ready. And then Henderson notices that Mellish is chewing gum, and he looks at him and goes, "You got any more of that?" And he basically halves it and gives it to him and puts it in his mouth, which I've always found pretty disgusting. But, you know, as we mentioned, you know, these guys don't know what's really in store for them, you know, how much longer they're going to be alive. So you know, might as well enjoy it while you can.
I have a lot to say about this, actually. So that scene to me depicts what I believe I see from the time that the German soldier, they're trying to decide if the German soldier is going to live or die.
Steamboat Willie.
Mm-hmm. All the way through to when, you know, kind of the battle here in Rommel is, you know, calmed down or whatever. And it's this whole idea where you see them, you know, you see the fight and you see them getting mad at each other and you see Tom Hanks, you know, solving the, you know, question of what he does in real life. And, you know, you see them finding Ryan and you see them being told that, you know, his brothers are gone and him saying, "I'm not leaving. I'm staying with my guys." And I'm staying
with the only family I have left.
Right. And then begin telling his stories of remembering his brothers. And, you know, then you see this splitting of the gum. And what you see there is you see this brotherhood that has been developed, this close-knit family sharing of the gum like that. That's a family thing that you do. You know, we share the same germs. That's what it is. And they did. They shared the same germs. They are that close. And when I watched all of that, it reminds me so much of what I have heard from the veterans for such a long time. And when I see them together, and it doesn't even have to be ones that have served together. And I have seen ones that have served in the same units be together, and it is so special. But I've seen ones that come together in Normandy that have never seen each other, didn't know each other, but they served in the same war. Mm-hmm. They can speak the same language. They have the same understanding of this period of time.
Things.
They saw the same things and they are instantly bonded just like brothers. And then you come down. I haven't mentioned this yet, but I have two sons that are in the military. And in my film, if you watch The Girl Who Wore Freedom, which you can, if you're in the US, you can find it on Amazon, Apple TV, Vudu, et cetera. If you watch that, you'll see that my oldest son, Hunter, was in the Army at the time. He's now in the Navy. And my younger son is in the Army as a mechanic. So I spent a lot of time with both of them. And what I see with them is the exact same thing. It's happening today. They spend time in the field or in, you know, these field exercises living with these guys. And that develops, that sense of brotherhood and family develops, and they fight like they hate each other and they want to kill each other. And then the next thing you know, they're their best friends. I mean, it's crazy. I don't understand it, but other than the fact, you know, and the sense of humor, like there's military humor that is absolutely horrific. Like seriously, if the real world heard what the military humor is, I mean, they would be in such trouble, but that's the way that they kept themselves sane. And so I talked to Hunter, who's fought in Afghanistan, and he explained this to me that, you know, this is their tribe.
That's right.
This is their tribe. And what happens when a lot of soldiers leave and get out and they finally have understood this is that the rate of alcoholism or drug use or even suicide is because they've lost their tribe. And
that's right.
You hear this from Sebastian Younger. I don't know if you've heard of the book Tribe, Homecoming and Belonging, but if you haven't read that book, that is a phenomenal explanation of exactly what I'm talking about. And he was embedded with Restrepo, actually. Joe Amity contributes to that movie. Restrepo is a great movie. You should talk about that.
Joe's connected to Restrepo? Wow. I didn't know that.
Joe distributes Restrepo. And so, Sebastian Younger, he's also a good friend with Sebastian Younger. You could probably get him on here. But he was embedded with these guys. And he then learns afterwards, like what their life is like. And he learns about this when they get out and how lost they are. And so he writes this book, Tribe, Homecoming and Belonging, and talks about, you know, what happens to them. And that's what I see here.
Mm-hmm.
This is their tribe.
Again, you've hit the nail on the head there for sure. I mean, I talked about it a few weeks ago. When, you know, right after Miller tells Ryan, you know, why he's there. And then we see some of the other guys standing around and one of them goes, hey, what's going on? And he goes, Ryan lost his brother. And then he goes, which one? And he goes, all of them. Now, the thing that I picked up from that is, okay, Ryan's with these guys a day or two. So he's, you know, because remember Mendelsohn told us that, you know, that they grabbed Ryan and an officer grabbed Ryan and put him in this makeshift unit. So these are not necessarily guys that he's known for a long time, but you know, they're together this day, 2 days, whatever it is, they've formed this bond. And therefore
he already knows how many brothers he's got and who they are.
It doesn't matter.
Right. These guys already know that he's got, you know, three brothers that are also fighting in this war. And, you know, so it, you know, just a little line like that. And again, that's the whole idea of Band of Brothers. I mean, Stephen Ambrose wrote the book and they made the miniseries based on the idea that you know, brothers in arms will have lifelong connections. And it doesn't matter if it's World War II, it doesn't matter if it's Vietnam, doesn't matter if you're talking about the American Revolution. I mean, any war, when you have guys that are together, you know, it's not just in war. I mean, it could also just be, you know, an army unit that's together. It's the same thing.
It's called trauma bonding. And truthfully, it is, you know, it could be in combat, but also when you go through a really tough thing like basic training or just living together, it's called trauma bonding. And you know, on a side note, as an actor, this is what actors love about shooting and being on set, principal photography. Because you are together in like this stressful situation and you become a family really quick. Back me up here, John. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
You become a family. And so all of a sudden you have this closeness in a really short period of time where you've got this family for however long you're shooting and you become really close. Even, I mean, you've known these people 2 or 3 days, but you have these emotional bonds. That's why actors get in relationships with each other. This is my theory. You know, you are emotional people. You've brought these emotions out and now you're like these raw nerves or whatever. And you get to know each other on an intimate level. And when you leave, you're like popped out of a family and you're alone.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And
okay, it's very interesting.
So it's true in the acting world.
Yeah.
Right. So Corey, I have a question for you about that then. You know, are you, did you bond with anyone on the set of Saving Private Ryan that you're still in touch with?
No, it wasn't there long enough really to bond with anybody.
Trauma bonding from that movie.
No. There were guys, look, there was a guy who was a spark. He was an electrician. His name was Dave. And there've been about three or four movies that I've worked on that I found out he was working on. And I would just see him somewhere and I'd go, Dave? He'd go, hello, Corey. And I was like, dude, we got to play some golf. And it's like, okay, let's go play some golf. We played golf in Ireland. We played golf, I think, once in Malta, a couple other places. Oh, wow. So that I was always, interesting, Christian. I'm such a theater animal that I never really felt like I was completely at home on a film set. And I have watched actors with jealousy who I know are very, very comfortable on a film set. Ed Burns was one of them. Ed Burns, he grew up on a film set. You know, he became who he was on his film set. And he within a few years of the Brothers McMullen coming out, he was in Private Ryan. He did other things. You know, he was working with all
these great people. He gets second billing in this movie. You know
what?
He gets second billing in this movie. That already says something.
Well, and he was huge. You know, he told us a story about when the Brothers McMullen was his first one. He was working in the mailroom at ICM in Los Angeles, and on a Friday evening he drove to Sundance.
Wow.
Because the Brothers McMullen was showing on Saturday afternoon, you know? So he drove to Sundance and crashed in his car. He got up, he went to check the theater, he did such and such, the movie played, he came back, hey, good. And the next day, they have a thing where you go and sit in a room behind a desk, and people come and say, I really liked your movie, here's my card, get in touch. And he went, okay. And so he goes there, and there's like a line of people coming out of the door, and he's going, well, someone hit it big. He goes and sits down, they're for him. He said, wow. Maybe 150 industry people went, you've got to get in touch with me. I absolutely loved your movie. We got to talk. And it's all for him. He said the only reason he went back to the mailroom on one day was to resign. You know, he said, I'm done.
Wow.
And I think he then went upstairs and met with half a dozen agents at ICM, and they pitched him what they were going to do for him. So in a weekend, his life changed. And that's getting thrown up. That's being born on a film set. I'm used to working in theater, and I've also learned how to pull back, because you can't anymore. You invest yourself in the role and what you're doing. You can't anymore invest yourself into people because of that. You know, these guys were traumatized, and I'm not in any way comparing what we do to what they did. They were traumatized from doing it that one time.
Yeah.
If I'm lucky, I'm going to do six or eight jobs a year. I can't go through that six or eight times.
Right. You know? Yeah. You do have to learn how to protect yourself.
Just learn to protect yourself. Yeah. So, it's not as glamorous.
You did make friends. You did make some friends on Band of Brothers, didn't you?
Well, sure. There are people on Band of Brothers who I still talk to every once in a while. Ross McCall, Tom Hardy was on Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
I worked with Tom in Black Hawk Down, and I also did a movie called The Code with him and Robert Forster about 5 or 6 years after Band of Brothers. That was right around the time we were doing The Code that Tom said, yeah, I've been offered this role and I've got to gain 50 pounds of muscle for it. And I said, dude, you can't do that in 2 months. He said, oh yeah, I can't. Don't worry about it. And he sends me these pictures of himself and he's all like this. And I went, holy cow, man, he's bald with a mustache. It was Bronson, you know, that was the movie that made him.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know so much crap. I can't even believe it. It's crazy.
I'm a font. I'm a font of crap.
Right. All right. Let's keep moving here. So then we get a shot with Ed Burns and Matt Damon. The two of them are sitting there also waiting for the tank to show up. And
I love that, where they look at each other. That's that knowing look of like, we've gone through all this shit. Guys have died. I've not wanted to do this, but now, I think, you know, you didn't want to leave. I have respect for you, man. All right.
He gives him a nod of approval at the time. So right. It's great.
Yeah. I'm over my anger. We're in this together. Let's do this.
Yeah.
That's right. And then the shot changes and we see the guys in their foxholes. We see, Mike in front of them. Also, just they give us their perspective of the street waiting for, you know, the tanks to finally show up. And
you can hear them, but you can't see them.
That's right. And then you see a whole bunch of German soldiers just scuttle across the screen, in the distance. Along.
And then behind them.
And then behind them comes the tank.
Right, right.
And I mean, this is just done so well because it really gives us the anticipation that these characters are having, you know, and it puts us there that we're also anticipating. We're waiting. Okay, we know that the tank is supposed to turn down the street. And then you see the tank just passes by them.
Yeah.
And, you know, at this point, Miller just says, Panzer didn't take the bait. You know, he knows that his plan just didn't work of what he wanted.
He was a shot. Know,
that's right.
No.
And then and then he looks up at Jackson up in the bell tower, you know, trying to get some sort of an idea. And I mean, Christian, I think you mentioned this at the beginning, he's looking for Jackson for help, but he's also looking up into the heavens, asking for some sort of divine help, you know, with what they have to do here, because he knows that
I think that was really John. Not in... I mean, Corey.
Oh, Corey said it. I don't remember which one he said. Sorry.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's just one of those things. I mean, we do a lot of things. We things, you know, it's like they say, the reason something is a cliche is that it's true. You know, you don't, a cliche doesn't become a cliche because it's bullshit. It becomes a cliche because it's the truth. And the idea of doing this and looking up and you go, I'm not certain if I can't remember ever in my life looking up to look for God or a God, but I know you look up to kind of go and to get like a breath in you, you know, you don't look down, you look, there's something, it's like when you look to the right, you're thinking with the left side of your brain. When you look to the left, you're thinking with the right side of your brain. There are indicators that we have. And I think it's one of those lovely artistic kind of moments that he looks up, but there's always a practical reason for us looking up. We never just simply go, God, it's me, Margaret, where are you? You know, there's a reason for him looking up, and it just works in two ways. That's the beauty of a movie, is it's never completely practical. It's always ever so slightly, there's an artistic license that comes into play that gives us, again, it's the luxury of being able to think in a way those men aren't able to think. You know, we can say, oh, look, he's invoking the deity there. And it's like, no, I'm hoping the sniper can shoot the tank. You know, that's what I'm hoping. Right. You know, that's really. Right.
Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective with these type of things.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, but it's what's brilliant about it. You know, it's like, and you know, talking of another war movie that he made, Schindler's List, he took a real chance shooting the scenes. In like one of the scenes where the little girl is walking around and she's got a red coat on, everything else is in black and white, except you see this red coat. He took a real chance because it's such an obvious thing to do. And it calls attention to itself as a trick of the cinema. But in that moment of the movie, you believe that what was going on is that's the only clean bit of colored clothing in this entire city, because everything else was so oppressively gray and oppressively dirty and oppressively downtrodden that this poor little girl walking around in what looked like a gray red coat was the only bit of vibrancy left. And it worked not only practically, but it worked as a metaphor in the movie, which I mean, I think is why, you know, one of the reasons why he's, you know, ostensibly one of the greatest, certainly in the top five filmmakers of all time.
Correct.
You know, and that's a heady list because, you know, you've got some great every decade, another five come out and you go, well, these men are geniuses, you know, but it's like Steven has stood kind of the test of time, you know, where his movies become more beautiful. Even the early ones become more beautiful. You find more things in them. You never look at Jaws and go, Yeah, you can really see the wheels turning there. You can see the gaps. There were no gaps. You look at the bit where they find the shark tooth and you go, that was shot in a swimming pool? And you go, yes, it was. Shot in a swimming pool.
Yes.
Because he didn't have the studio time or the money to shoot it properly, so he did what he could, and he makes it work. You don't see the joins with him, which is why he's brilliant.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so we've made it through this minute. So let's do miracle. Today's segment.
Miracle.
Yeah. Hey, it's been fascinating. Don't get me wrong. So.
I don't know if this is better or worse than the last one we were on, but anyway, go on.
So every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests, because it's two of you, will give me their top five John Williams movie scores themes. So I think the best way to probably do this is just do it in snake fashion. So, Christian, why don't you start off with your number five, and then Corey will give us his five. And then his four, and then your four, we'll just, quickly go through that in snake fashion.
All right. My number five, Harry Potter.
Oh, my God. We're just going to do this just one up. You're not going to explain why it's great?
You can if you want. Whatever you prefer. Why?
Just, give me some stuff about Harry Potter.
I mean... You're asking me to give you I have to.
Why do you like it?
Why do I like it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I like all of these because they stick with you, right? Yeah. They stick with you. You know instantly when you hear it what it is. There's absolutely no question, and that's the thing with all of these that I'm going to tell you, and with John Williams tunes.
Yeah.
They are just so iconic that you hear them instantly and you know what movie that is, and it puts you right in the middle of the movie. Like, it's not just you hear a song, but you hear the theme song and all of a sudden you're in the middle of the movie. Like, you're in the middle of the feeling of the
Right.
I can hear the Harry Potter theme song and I can all of a sudden feel like the feelings of
Hogwarts. Yeah.
You feel the magic.
Yeah. I mean, I hate putting them in a list of preference. So I'm going to try and go in some kind of chronological order. So, I mean, my number five would be
chronological. That's crazy. I don't know how you can do that.
Well, but because I'm going early when I first recognized who did that. It was there. I don't think there's been a theme that is more singularly evocative of a movie than the theme from Jaws.
Of course.
So you would put that as your number five?
See, I started because with number it's the five.
First one. I know. You because asked it's, what... No, because it's the first one. Because I'm going to go and I'm going to say, look, you write two notes. He wrote two notes. Ba-dum, ba-dum. And then he basically went bum 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 with every once in a while going bum 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 bum. And then he added a couple of things, but it will always bum 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 bum. And that was it. That was the movie. But you can't hear that. It's not even a song.
He's breaking the rules. He's breaking the rules.
But there are themes, but that to me is the most complete and perfect.
Okay, so he's giving his number one. I gave my number five. Now what?
That's my number five. That's my number five.
Your number five. Okay, go to your number four. Go to your number four.
Me?
No, it's you. No, Corey. Now it's you.
Oh, my number four. Superman. And I will say not only the overture to Superman, because there are moments in the movie where you hear the brilliance of his soundtrack, like. This is what he does through his scores. When he shows the planet Krypton, you come up on Krypton from space and you see the planet and you see the way the buildings are and how striking they are. And all he plays is da da ba 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 ba. And he plays it different. He plays it, there's a different undertone to it. And by the time he gets to the final phrase, bum, 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 there's something else that has happened that tells an entire story.
Right.
And that's why he's brilliant. And look, you've got the Superman theme as well. Bum, 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 da, dum, ba, da, bum. That's evocative of Superman. It's brilliant.
Right.
And Can You Read My Mind, the love theme from Superman, is also but those moments, the things like that, they don't leave you. And so you hear the overture of that and you get all of them and you go back when you hear it after the movie, you go back and you go, oh my God, that was a beautiful moment. So you remember the movie as well, you know?
Yes.
Because it's mm-hmm. it locks you in.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. All right, Christian, your turn, number four.
So I'm going to have Corey describe my movies because he also puts the song in there. So, okay, Corey, my number four is Jurassic Park. So why don't you describe why my number four would be Jurassic Park? Why is it so great?
Obviously, because it's not just how do you evoke a dinosaur? You can't, but it's the way, and this is just my opinion. There are things in the theme, because this would have been my number three. There are things in the theme that evoke a kind of a, it reminds me, if I was going to sum it up in a phrase, it would be the return of the king.
There's a sense for me, that, like, I feel like it's so big. Like when I hear it, like, you know how the gates in Jurassic Park are so
Yeah.
And like, you know, and the dinosaurs are so huge. I feel like the beginning of that music is just so big.
It's kind
of like that.
But big the way it starts from something so small where he just goes ba-da-da, and it just builds onto something else. And by the time he gets to the phrase ba-da-da, this is the brilliance of John Williams. Ba 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 ba. I'm gonna do it wrong. Ba 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 ba. That's not what he did. He goes ba 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 ba. And it's just like, oh man, just a little tiny moment like that of making you. He grabs you and picks you up to their level and says, "Go on, live with them, see what they are." You know, that's what makes him a genius.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, you're number three, Christian.
Yeah, I got out of the sequence, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, Catch Me If You Can.
Wow, good choice.
First of all,
you're just a jazz fan.
I love the jazz. I love the movie. Like, it's going to be on my Steven Spielberg.
Hey, don't give it away. Don't give it away.
Sorry. I love the movie. I absolutely adore the movie. And so the music to me puts you right in the time of the, you know, right in the time period of the film. And so that for me, it sets the stage and it's really unique. So that's why I love it. John could probably elaborate better than me.
No. I was just going to say, you know, the whole thing, again, just the fact that, you know, the thing it tells you about the character is that this guy was literally flying by the seat of his pants. And there's something about a knowledge he gained and used maybe before he completely owned the knowledge, which there's something about jazz that is like that, where you can be a great musician, but jazz is encouraging you not to live where you know, it's not to live where you know, but to attempt to live in places you're not aware of yet. Right. And so, you know, that's how you grow as an artist, is by, you know, expanding that.
There's this wonderful line in La La Land where you know, Sebastian is trying to teach Mia like the beautifulness of jazz. And he's like, you know, he takes her to this jazz club and he's like, look, you know, you see this guy? He's right now taking over. He's like taking over. He's like grabbed it and he's now like, you know, and now he's fighting for the, you know, the stage and he's trying to take over you know, and that is the wonderfulness of jazz, is that, you know, you never know what's going to happen and somebody can like take it and run with it. And that is what happens in Catch Me When You Can, is that, you know, the main character, you never know what he's going to do. And he's always stealing stuff. So.
Yeah.
Right.
All right.
Go on. Corey, your number three, you said is Jurassic Park, right?
My number three is Jurassic Park.
Okay, so what's your number two then?
My number two is Schindler's List.
Ooh.
And the reason it's number two, there's.
Well, because chronologically, it came out the same year as.
yeah, No, but I was saying vague. It was vague chronological. But the reason it's number two is there are very few. There are very few movies nowadays that are made where you have a composer. People just take pop songs and put them in because they're a cheap, quick way of getting to the emotional content of a scene. They indicate to the audience exactly where they should be in order to experience this scene. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they play, you know, a pop song and it tells people, oh, that was 1978 or I was 10 or I was 15 or I was 22 or whatever. And it's about this. And so I know that's because it parallels what they're going through. Okay, so I'm good. But it's a layer of separation. There's one guy writing today. And I want to say it's the guy who did Meet Joe Black. It's like Thomas Newton or something.
No.
Thomas Howard Newton.
Thomas Newton Howard?
It's not Thomas Newton. It's Newton.
Anyway, look it up. There are things he uses. There are phrases he uses that are dissonant, that don't play nicely with one another. The notes don't play nicely. He does it on purpose, and he doesn't do the thing you expect. He goes off on 90-degree angles in his music, and it's the only
Randy
way to...
Newman.
No.
Randy.
No.
No. Oh, No.
And the only way to describe it is agonizing.
Thomas Newman.
The only way to describe it is agonizing. His chord choices and the way he layers notes on top of one. I could play phrases for you that it's agony to listen to. He's doing it not because of what's going on in the scene. Of course, what's going on in the scene isn't agonizing, but his music is telling you things about the people that you don't know from seeing what they're experiencing. Schindler's List just underscores the experience, but does it in the most beautifully horrifying way. Because he asked him to write the score, and he said, "Well, I'd love to have a look at the movie." And he showed him the movie, and he said, "I can't write music to this. You've got to get someone else to do it." He said, "Well, I would, but the guys who are better than you are all dead." You know, meaning you're the only person alive who can write this. And that's why he's as great as he is, because, you know, down the line, he was probably the only person alive who could have written these scores. You know?
Yeah.
Wow. He's that good.
Yes. All right, Christian, what's your number two?
Okay, well, we're going to have to skip my number two and go to my number one, because number two is Jaws, so I'm going to give you my number one.
Well, you're not skipping it. You just have to tell me what it is, and you don't have to then explain it.
Why, though? Why do you like Jaws?
Well, I mean, same reason you like Jaws, so I'm not going to re-describe it, you know? It's just iconic, super scary, and it's the same reason. Two notes.
Yeah.
In fact, it's so scary, I never seen it. I've seen scenes.
Oh my God.
I was a little kid and I was so scared by the music and the picture of the poster and the commercial, I would never go see it. So I've never seen it.
Can I just say, we're talking about the music, so I'll just talk about the music. There is a point when they realize they're on the trail of this shark and John Williams writes chase music that makes you think, they're going to get him. This is great. They're going to get him. And they don't know, and you don't either, what it is they're up against.
Correct.
And when you discover what they're up against, the music disappears. There's no, I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
To the point where the shark goes back under the water.
Right.
The shark goes under the water.
The music goes under the water with him. After the Indianapolis speech, there's very little music.
Correct.
You know? And it's just like, that's the last 20 minutes
of
the movie.
That's what, I mean, silence, when you have a great composer and you have a good director that knows how to use the silence of no music.
Afraid of the silence.
Yeah, that is,
look at this movie, Saving Private Ryan. Most of the movie does not have a score.
Yeah.
No, right.
You know, there's a right. few, right. There are moments that have it, and then right. the end, you know.
Because it was important to have the sound.
Yes.
It was important yeah. to have the noise. And it wasn't like all explosions and all. It was like the tanks coming from a long way off. And this was something that was created because people have said, you fire a bullet into water and the bullet almost immediately stops. It doesn't keep going through. You can't get killed by a bullet underwater. And I was
going, huh. Sure you can.
Yeah, you can get killed. Because a lot of people in Pearl Harbor in died that way. Yeah.
In the movie, we see people getting killed.
There were guys who were saying, yeah, you just can't. And the bullets don't travel through water like that. They weave and they... You know, they turn right. like fish, but they're slowing down exponentially.
They slow down, but right. they still can kill you underwater. And I will say that I really struggled with this movie score thing in my own film, because you can overscore a movie yes. and it overtakes the film.
Yeah.
And you also have to figure out you can underscore it as well. So yeah. that was very difficult for me to figure out where that nuance. And I think if I could critique that film on anything, I think I overscored it a little. And if mm-hmm. I was going to go back and do anything, I would probably remove a little bit of the score in a mm-hmm. couple of places. Not much, just a tad. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, that it is hard to get comfortable with the silence in a movie. So the master stroke of what mm-hmm. he did there in Jaws is amazing. Mm-hmm. So now can I go to my number one?
Yeah.
Yes, you can.
What do you think it is?
Same as mine.
What'd you say?
Same as mine.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Star Wars.
I mean, how could it not be?
Yeah, it's got to be. Yeah.
I mean.
You didn't just go in chronological order.
No, I can't. I said that as a ruse.
It just has to be Star Wars, you know, because it was the movie, of course, was so revolutionary during that time. The score mm-hmm. had to be as well. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there's just nothing, like it, you know,
they made those movies. Lucas made Star Wars around the same time Spielberg was making Close Encounters.
Yeah.
And they were on a beach in Hawaii at one point before Star Wars came
know
out.
This. How do you know these
I
things?
That's when they
thought of Indiana Jones.
And they yeah. And they but they were both going, well, this is gonna be horrible, man. We're never gonna make movies again, you know? And they didn't know, you know. I mean, not that Star Wars made Close Encounters possible, because they're very different movies, but Close Encounters built on what Star Wars had made possible. You right. know, I think without Star Wars, Close Encounters would have been a niche movie, and instead it became one of the titles of the 70s, you know.
Correct.
We did it.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
And I mean, look, Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, that's a great, right. great theme as well. Yeah.
Yes.
For sure. There you go.
All right. Well, thank you both for those lists. So, Christian, do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Yes, absolutely. Well, my production company is Documentary First Productions. So that's documentaryfirst.com. And you can find me there, my movie's there. And if you want to write me, ask more questions, Christian@documentaryfirst.com.
All right. And Corey, how can people get in touch with you? They want to?
They can't. No one can get in touch with me. You just got to take a shot. You turn on, if you're up after 2 a.m. and you're watching an obscure television channel, you'll probably see me walk across your screen.
You can look him up on IMDb and you can see his huge list of credits.
Watch Midnight Caller. It's on, I think it's on Amazon Prime, Apple TV. It's streaming right now in America. So Midnight Caller. It's a movie that was made in 2020. I think it was released in 2024. So it's not the TV series with Gary Cole, but it is about a disc jockey. So, you know.
Yeah, that's his latest one.
Yeah, so. Guess who plays the disc jockey?
Go check that out. Also, all my social medias are Documentary First. So you can check that out. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter.
And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. Wow. What did you think about that episode? haunting Corey Johnson with reveries from Days Gone By. I absolutely love it. I can't think of anything I would rather do. How amazing. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that deep dive and all the side tangents that Rob, Corey, and I went on. You know, I think we spend about 4 or 5 days or a million talking about this 1 minute of Saving Private Ryan. Who knew there was so much to say about 1 minute in Saving Private Ryan? But I guess, to be fair, we didn't just talk about one movie in 1 minute in Saving Private Ryan. And also, to be fair, C.O. Bauer will take 1 day in the chair for Corey Johnson. And that episode will be coming up right around D-Day, I think. Anyway, there's still a couple of more episodes to come, so stay tuned as we continue this conversation coming up in the next couple of weeks, and as we bring you more episodes from Documentary First, along with these special movie Rob Bennett episodes. Until then, earn this. And if you know, then you know. And if not, well, you better go back and listen to some of the episodes before this one. Thank you for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody. Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. Or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.